I've been handed an announcement. I want to assure you before I make it that no emergency is involved at all, but would a parent who belongs to Thomas Quinn go down to the nursery, please? I think Tommy decided not to feel well or something. It's a great pleasure to see so many people visiting us this morning, far more than I can recognize. So I ask to be forgiven for special reasons if I say to you that it is an extraordinary joy to me to see Dennis Bearden sitting in this room. Some of you will know why. It gives me so much pleasure. Dennis and Elizabeth, a very special welcome. We talked last week about the Last Supper in the upper room and how two very common events were turned into symbols. The use of a broken loaf and red wine to represent the body and blood of Jesus, both to be spent soon on the cross, and the bathing of the disciples' feet by Jesus as a lesson in humility. Judas left the room early that night. The others, under a full moon, made their way through narrow streets back to their sleeping quarters in one of the suburbs of Jerusalem. That's the beginning. I'm going to pause and invite you to listen carefully, particularly if you are a visitor, because I am not going to say completely conventional things, and I'd like you to be aware of the extent of your disagreement, or I would love to think of your agreement. Jesus, after what seemed to have been private remarks made to Judas, was subdued when they left the upper room and very apprehensive. He was afraid that in the coming crisis, his friends would forsake him, and he spoke that fear out loud. Simon Peter, always the quickest mouth in the East, made his quick boast, "Even if all the rest desert you, you can bet that I won't." It was poor comfort to Christ, who loved his friend, but understood human weakness very well. He said, "I must tell you this, Peter, that on this very night, before the morning cock crows, you yourself will disown me three times." Well, Peter did not give up easily. "Even if I have to die with you," he said, "I will never disown you." All of them said the same thing. They would never turn their backs on him. When they came in their walk that night to a thick grove of olive trees known as the Garden of Gethsemane, Jesus abruptly decided to stop where he had often been before and to seek solace for his troubled soul in prayer. He left the main group, but he took Peter, James, and John a little deeper into the garden, wanting the comfort of their presence. "My heart is sad," he told them, "sad even unto death. Stay here and watch with me." This man was not a Stoic. Like the rest of us, He dreaded to suffer. He was not eager to die. He left his three most intimate friends, went deeper still into the shadows, threw himself on the ground, and prayed that if there were any other way, he would like to be spared the horrors that seemed so close. Anything is possible for you, he said to God. Take this cup away from me. Don't let any theology you have been given rob this moment of its poignancy. He meant it. He was no alien on a quick visit to earth, programmed for sudden death and a quick resurrection. He was one of us. His prayer strikes a familiar note. Some of you have spoken it. Take away this cup. I don't want to die like this. When he came back, his exhausted friends were all fast asleep. And when they were startled awake, blushing and full of excuses, he chided them gently. Weren't you able to make it for just 1 hour? But in his usual way, he made apologies for them. The spirit, indeed, is willing, but the flesh is weak. The words of tender insight that have provided so many of us since with the only excuse we have. It happened a second time, and a third, this failure to stay awake, and perhaps he had already heard a noise, seen a movement in the shadows, because he said suddenly to them, "The time is up. The Son of Man is betrayed into the hands of wicked men." And as he spoke, Judas arrived with a crowd of armed men to arrest him. No one wanted to seize the wrong man and have Jesus get away in the darkness and confusion. So Judas had promised to identify his friend with a kiss. Men often greeted one another that way, as you've seen the Russians do, and Yasser Arafat, who reinforces my preference for handshakes. So there was the false hug and a kiss on the cheek. And as that happened, Jesus spoke the word that later drove a remorseful Judas to kill himself. Friend, do what you came to do. Under cover of night, the disciples all fled in panic. And the police led Jesus back through the sleeping city to the house of the high priest. They called a rump session of the Sanhedrin, and the first of several trials got underway. Some of the guards relieved the tedium of the night by playing the games any prisoner might expect from them. They spit on Jesus to show contempt. They put a blindfold over his face, slap him, and say, "Okay, you're a prophet. Tell us who hit you." It was to be a long, long night. In another part of town, trying to be inconspicuous at the edge of a crowd, Peter, bold, brave Peter, was spotted by a servant girl who thought she recognized him. And while dangerous men looked at him suspiciously, Peter denied being a disciple. It didn't work. Somebody said, "You are too one of that crowd. We can tell by your Galilean accent." And then, more frightened than ever, the big fisherman began in panic to swear that he was not a friend to Jesus. "I don't even know this man." It was a moment that would haunt him for the rest of his life. Jesus, in the meantime, had been sent on to Pilate. In town for the Passover, from his governor's headquarters at Caesarea, the only official who could impose or execute the death sentence. Pilate was not much interested in Jewish quarrels, but it was his job to defend Roman authority against men who might start a revolution. So he asked the one important question: "Are you the king of the Jews?" Jesus accepted the title, but apparently in such a way that Pilate had some doubts. So as the high priest continued to accuse Christ, Pilate asked, "Have you no answer to make to these charges that they are bringing against you?" Feeling that talk was useless, Jesus refused to reply. And I think Pilate rather admired his stubborn courage, because when a delegation came to request amnesty for a prisoner on that special day to be set free during the Passover, Pilate said, "Why not this one here?" Pointing to Jesus, "This king of yours, I could set him free." It sounds as if he had made up his mind that Jesus was not really a threat to the Roman Empire. But he underestimated the hatred of the priests and their friends who insisted that Barabbas be set free and not Jesus, and who, when asked, "Then what shall I do with the man you call king of the Jews?" screamed, "Crucify him." Even Pilate is shocked by their ferocity. He tries to reason with them. "What has this man done that is so bad?" They really had nothing more to add. But Jesus had challenged their authority and their system, had made them look foolish and greedy. So they howled the words again in angry unison, "Crucify him." Pilate was a politician. First, a human being afterwards. So he gave them the other prisoner, ordered Jesus to be flogged, and handed him over to a squad of soldiers for crucifixion. Just that casually, it was done. But Pilate had looked into a face that was not ordinary, had met the eyes, had seen the dignity of a man who, even in his death, would make conquest of half the world. And he was not at peace with himself. He called for a bowl of water, washed his hands solemnly before the crowd, and said, "I am not to blame for this man's death. This has been your business." And they said, "Fine, we'll take the blame." And along with the soldiers, dragged Jesus into the street to begin the march to Golgotha, the place where so many death sentences had been carried out. But there was to be a little more fun first. They dressed the prisoner in the royal red cloak of a king, covering up the blood of his beating. They made a wreath out of thorns and shoved it down over his head as a kind of mock crown, and shouted, "Long live the King of the Jews!" It was hilarious. Some of them knelt down and pretended to be obedient subjects. Others hit him with sticks. But in a day when the Emperor Augustus had set as many as 10,000 men fighting one another to death to entertain the Roman public, one single life, one obscure life in a remote and backward country meant nothing to these troops far away from home. So they teased him until the game got tiresome, and then they went on toward the small round hill called the Place of the Skull. Along the way, hundreds of ordinary people fell in behind the parade, some of them undoubtedly mourning for the prisoner. No one tried to shoo them away. The Romans felt that it was instructive for as many people as possible to witness what Cicero called the most cruel and hideous of all forms of torture. Our old Western rope over a tree, our electric chair, gas chamber, lethal injection, they're all quite humane by comparison with death by crucifixion. With hands and feet either tied or nailed, the badly beaten victim hangs awkwardly for anywhere from 1 to 3 days, depending on his strength, unable to brush away flies crawling on his wounds, his heart and lungs congested, the muscles of his body cramped in agonizing spasms, mouth and throat parched with unbearable thirst. It was so terrible a death that Rome protected her own citizens from it and reserved that kind of dying for those nations she needed to frighten. Brave men gave up in wars with the Romans rather than face the prospect of being crucified if they held out. The Gospels differ quite a bit on exactly what happened in those last few hours. And the serious student, and that's what I ask you to be now, has to make some attempt to separate what seems likely as fact from the embellishments of later disciples who had no interest in being the reporters of literal truth. One can be excused for wondering if perhaps the darkness that came over the land from noon until 3 o'clock was a literary symbol for nature's own dismay at the death of such purity and innocence. I learned once how darkness can come into the brightest of days when someone dies. There is no independent witness to an eclipse that day, as there are no non-Christian witnesses to all those miracles, stupendous miracles, Matthew talks about in his gospel. An earthquake that would be noticed. The temple curtain, torn from top to bottom, rocks split, graves opened, corpses standing up and walking into town. I think this is how poetry says that the world convulses when the Son of God is put to death. For if it had all quite literally happened, then one would expect some mention of it in letters or official records, and there is none. Quakes, multiple resurrections, one would expect the word to go all around the Mediterranean world, and that did not happen. It seems likely that this death began to be sentimentalized right away after it happened, human nature being what it is. And certainly Luke's account of it is a great deal more inspiring than Mark's, who wrote first. It is Luke who gives us the immortal, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do," which is so true to the character of Christ that no Christian reader would want to do without it. And it is also Luke who gives us the beautiful resignation of, "Father, into thy hands I commit my spirit." But I would guess we are nearer the literal and unadorned truth when we read the stark simplicity of Mark's account, still untouched by the glosses of later ingenuity and adoration. At 3:00 p.m, Mark tells us, Jesus cries out with a loud voice, quoting in Aramaic the first line of the 22nd Psalm, which asks the last desperate question that can be wrung from the heart of one who feels abandoned. Why, my God, have you forsaken me? Since the first word in Aramaic is the word Eloi, someone thought he was calling for Elijah. And so there was one last joke. Let's wait and see whether Elijah will come and take him down from the cross. It is part of the amazing candor of this terrific narrative in Mark that nothing romantic or sentimental is put into the mouth of Christ. There is simply the bitter cry of disappointment and despair and one final scream in which Mark can locate no words at all, and then the final breath. The crowd straggles slowly away to other diversions. The soldiers cast lots to see who will get the clothing when the three dead men are taken down, and the terrified disciples wonder in their hiding places if this is also going to happen to them. Their dreams of a kingdom and who would have the prominent places in it have now become the grimmest of jokes. He had warned them that the shadow of a cross lay over Jerusalem, but they had not believed him. Now their hopes are all extinct, and the life that once seemed bright as the morning sun has faded into darkness. What a pathetic end it seemed to be to the greatest dream in history.